And you're listening to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
On May 14th, the Israeli military slaughtered 62 Palestinians as they massed at Gaza's border with Israel, demanding their right to return to their homeland. But this is not the first time Israel has murdered unarmed Gazan civilians. Independent journalists Mac Blumenthal and Dan Cohen documented Israel's 2014 assault on Gaza during the war and chronicled its horrific aftermath. As they waded through the rubble of Gaza's destroyed border regions, they turned a camera onto the survivors of the slaughter and let them speak for themselves. While giving voice to the pain of a people under siege, Cohen and Blumenthal also highlighted Gazans' inspiring act of creative resistance, from painting to breakdancing to literature that allowed them to maintain their humanity in the face of deprivation and war. Killing Gaza is much more than a documentary about Palestinian resistance and suffering. It is a chilling visual document of war crimes committed by the Israeli military, featuring direct testimony and evidence from the survivors, delivered to them often just days after escaping indiscriminate shelling, bombings, and summary execution. And now we welcome Max Blumenthal, director and writer of Killing Gaza. He is a senior editor of the Greystone Project at Alternet and the award-winning author of Goliath, Republican Gomorrah, and the 51-Day War. And Dan Cohen, cinematographer and editor of Killing Gaza. He is a journalist and filmmaker.
I really want to understand the background and the politics that prompted both of you to use cinematography as a way of telling the story of this strip that is 6 miles wide and 27 miles long, has 2 million people enclosed in what is oftentimes described as the largest open-air prison in the world.
Dan Cohen and I would both define ourselves as anti-Zionist Jews. We both grew up in very Zionist communities. I grew up in Washington, D.C. My family I would describe as non-Zionist, and they've always encouraged me to question everything, so they didn't really have a problem to my emerging politics, and I think I was going where more progressive-minded American Jews was going, and Dan as well, and it led me as a journalist to start deciding to use my privilege as a Jew to gain access to the land of Israel-Palestine and present the real Israel that Americans didn't know and help start this process of education so we could have a debate in the U.S. And that's why I produced the book Goliath that was 5 years in the making. And, you know, I thought that I had kind of succeeded enough with that book that I could maybe move on to other topics. And then the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip took place. I managed to get into Gaza along with Dan. Dan had been living in the Aida refugee camp or near it in the West Bank, and we connected and went in there not knowing totally what to expect. And we wound up a few hours after getting credentialed in the rubble, the destroyed eastern border area of Shujaiya, which had been blanketed by Israeli artillery, talking to the stunned survivors of this attack in the ruins of their homes. Dan just had a small camera and one mic, and we decided to just keep going. And as we kept going, a documentary took form, and I would kind of let Dan explain, I mean, not only his background, but how he kept the filming going over the course of another year.
You know, I didn't really grow up in any kind of politicized community. Much of my identity as a secular Jewish American from the suburbs of Phoenix was, you know, to be supportive of Israel, as if to be a good Jew is to support Israel. I had my bar mitzvah in Israel, Jerusalem, and it wasn't until my early 20s when I was in college and I took a history class that I started to get a grasp of what had actually happened in that country, and I became uncomfortable with that and started consuming a lot of media, reading a lot of books. Eventually, I found myself reading Max's book, Goliath. That was one of the major inspirations for me, pushed me over the edge to say, like, I'm going to dive into journalism head first and go to Palestine and just take my camera and see what happens. And that's what I did, and right after I arrived, I moved into the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, and I just saw this daily violence. Aida camp is used more tear gas than anywhere in the world. I would see Israeli soldiers shoot children on a daily basis, just really the horrors of everyday occupation in the West Bank. few months later, Max and I met. We got credentialed, went into the Gaza Strip. You know, my background at that point was in photography. I didn't really know anything about video, but I just felt like it was such a powerful form. I started taking footage just of our interviews that we were getting in the rubble so we could transcribe the content for written articles. But it became very clear to us that the content we were getting, the testimonies of survival and death, were so compelling, so powerful, that they should form the basis for a documentary. The content was so strong. We stayed until the end of the assault, and I decided to make it my kind of personal mission to continue to go back and document life after the ceasefire, which was really a one-way ceasefire. You know, you'd still have periodic bombings, Israeli soldiers shooting into the border areas all the time, and all of these Palestinians who'd had their homes destroyed. There were more than 100,000 homes destroyed in Gaza. They were largely not allowed to rebuild their homes. So there was nothing normal about life in Gaza, and I wanted to document that and show the everyday crises that Palestinians were surviving under through the winter in the freezing rains. Babies are actually freezing to death, and we show that. We have the mother talking about that in the documentary, the Mediterranean summer, you know, right off the beach, where people whose homes were destroyed are living in shipping containers where it's just absolute misery, elderly people, children, suffering that really we in the U.S. and Israelis, you know, just a half a mile away in the border communities outside of Gaza, really cannot grasp. And so, you know, it was through film that we thought it was just the most powerful way to show this, especially in the age of social media and YouTube and Vimeo. And we're going to be pushed out. We're not going to be allowed into the mainstream. It's not going to be shown in AMC theaters. You know, we're not going to get interviews on CNN or MSNBC, but we're going to do it in a grassroots way. And really, people, I think, are hungry for it. And that's what we're seeing. So, you know, that's where we are today.
Well, you certainly succeeded. This is something that really makes the violence real and the murder real, the murder of civilians by the Israeli forces. Was it worse than you thought it would be?
One of the things that I've noticed, even for people who are sympathetic to Palestine, is just in how you experience the violence. And it's very difficult, obviously, to get into the Gaza Strip. It's one of the most off-limits places in the world. And so you experience the violence through a kind of simulacra, whether it's on your smartphone or a flat screen or your laptop, and you're seeing it kind of in bites and montages. I mean, it's hard to really get a full context, but more importantly, you can't experience intimacy with the victims of Israeli violence if you can't go to the Gaza Strip and really spend time there. And that's really what I wasn't expecting was the encounter with people who had withstood something that was completely unimaginable to me and, you know, even to them to some extent, and to witness how they coped with it. That was really the focus of our film and the goal of our film was to establish the atmosphere of siege and being on the receiving end of asymmetrical warfare, to follow these characters and show their psychological progression, their stoicism, the culture of resistance that they've formed to psychologically survive. From a cinematic point of view, what we aim to do aesthetically was to get as close to their faces as possible, to bring you into their world, into their homes, which in many cases were not really homes, they were rubble, to bring you as close as possible to sitting around a fire in the cold Gaza winter while it's raining outside, and to feel what it's like, because most people watching this film won't be able to be there. What they'll come away with is not only a kind of empathy, but also admiration for these people and what they're able to do under these circumstances. There's a lot of courage in Gaza that we don't understand unless, you know, you can either be there or you can have a kind of cinematic experience, like the kind that I'm confident we produced with Killing Gaza. You can watch it at killinggaza.com. Costs you probably less than a coffee to rent or buy the film.
The perpetual nature of the assault on each individual is so stark, is startling. You certainly get a sense of the disproportionate use of force, since we're always said the mythology that Israel is acting not as the purveyor of violence, but it is indeed the David to the Goliath of the great Arab world that seeks to destroy it. And you've really broken through that. It serves to me as a basis for a project that looked to the indictment, if nothing else, before a people's tribunal of war crimes. I wonder if you've thought of the film as serving as a mobilizing tool and indeed possibly an international war crime to finally tell it like it is on behalf of the freedom fighters of Gaza.
This is not just a documentary. It is a document that should be entered into evidence if there was an international criminal court. But if there's a people's tribunal, great. This film should be entered into evidence. We provided in this the first opening section of this film, but throughout the film, clear evidence of crimes against humanity committed by the State of Israel and done so deliberately against the civilian population.
The scope of the film, the idea of the film, and what's missing really in Western mainstream media is just to show Palestinians as human beings and, you know, have like an intimate portrait of them, that the most important thing is to understand that all of the suffering in Gaza is rubber stamped and paid for with American tax dollars, and we have to understand our own complicity in it. And, you know, if we really rallied in Washington, D.C., in New York, if there was, you know, enough people really getting out there, then I think the bipartisan consensus in U.S. politics of support for Israel, unbridled impunity, would really be challenged. And we'd see, especially in the Democratic Party, we would see the shift really taking place. And I think we do see it in terms of Democratic leaders or, you know, who have previously been vocally supportive of Israel, even during these massacres. In this most recent massacre where 60 people were gunned down simply for approaching the fence, they were gunned down by Israeli snipers who were totally untouchable, Democratic leaders have been silent. And so that indicates a real shift to me, and that is what we want to continue to hit on, to continue to press on. And that's, you know, the goal of the film.
Dan was able to get into a training camp of the Nasser al-Saladin Brigade, which is a popular resistance brigade. They're kind of the weekend warriors of Gaza. And he spoke to some of the young fighters on camera about why they fight. And it's something that people in the West will never hear. Why do they fight? They fight because their relatives, their parents, their friends, they've watched them be torn to shreds by Israeli missiles supplied by the United States. And that's what they say on camera. They don't give religious justifications. Dan asked them. Another thing Dan did was profile the younger brother of Salem Shamali, who is one of the most widely known deaths in the war. He was a 23-year-old street vendor who was looking for his cousin in the rubble. He was killed execution style by an Israeli sniper on camera. It was broadcast on international networks. And Dan followed Wasim and showed his development. Dan can talk about that, but you see Wasim turn from a regular kid into someone who wants to be a resistance fighter. And I thought this also helps us to understand why those young men rushed into the teeth of Israeli snipers and a hail of bullets pursuing freedom and ventilating their frustration with siege. We need to understand their lived experiences.
I do want you to talk more about the young brother of this man who we see being gratuitously and viciously executed by, whether it's a sniper or a group of snipers, it is one of the more gut-wrenching, painful films. Also, another element of the film, which is life, the resilience, and indeed the optimism and creativity that is physically expressed amidst all of this perpetual assault on the human spirit and the human body.
Salem Shomali was searching in the rubble of Shujaiya, which had been largely destroyed by Israeli artillery and tank shells, a whole neighborhood obliterated. So this young man went back to look for his cousin, search out family members who might have survived during the ceasefire, and he was accompanied by volunteers from the International Solidarity Movement as they were walking through the rubble, through these streets. An Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Salem Shomali, and he fell to the ground, and the rescuers couldn't reach him because they would be shot too. And then the Israeli sniper proceeded to finish him off with two more shots. This was captured on cell phone camera by a volunteer, Mohammed Abdullah, who's from Gaza. It was uploaded and went viral. So a couple days later, Salem Shomali was simply, he was unknown. No one knew who he was. He was just known as the man in the green shirt. So a few days later, an NBC report was sent to Salem Shomali's family, and that's how they learned of his death, just from a news report. And they heard his voice and instantly knew it was him, as he was, you know, crying out as he's dying. About 2 weeks later, Max and I went to visit the Shomali family in a home where they were staying in a relatively safer area in the center of Gaza City. The family was just completely devastated. It was just the most fresh wound for them, and everyone was deeply traumatized. And the youngest brother, Wasim, who I believe was 14 at that time, was a very mild-mannered, nice boy. He just told us how he missed his brother. He would take him out, buy him a candy, and take care of him and just hang out with him. And now there was no one there to do that. And so his voice was quivering, and he was crying, but he was so brave that he spoke to us on camera. About a year later, I went to the Shomali household again and caught up with them. And Wasim had, the trauma had basically scarred him so bad that he couldn't hear properly, couldn't really concentrate for long periods of time. He took me to the graveyard where Salem was buried, which was just a makeshift graveyard because the actual graveyard of Shujaiya was completely filled and was overflowing with bodies. And so basically empty lots of land were turned into makeshift graveyards. And so we went there, and he sat at his brother's grave and told me he goes there every Friday, doesn't really do much else. And all he thinks about now is joining the Al-Qassam Brigades, the main armed resistance groups. It's Hamas's armed wing. And not because he's some religious fanatic, but simply because he wants vengeance for his brother. Anybody can relate to that. And that's a pattern that I saw talking to so many young boys, especially, who had been either maimed themselves and had severe injuries, or their brothers or cousins or parents had been killed. There's a video I did for The Nation. It's called The Children Who Lived Under Israel's Missiles, about the Bakr boys who were hit by Israeli missiles. They were targeted as they were playing on the beach. There were 8 of them. 4 died, 4 survived. The 4 survivors, they all told me they want to be fighters. And every one of them, they're on that path. When those kids, in a few years, if they pop out of a tunnel and open fire on some Israeli pillbox military installation of some, like, 19-year-old soldiers sitting around eating bomba, then it'll be very clear why it happened. And all the faux outrage that we'll see in Western media about terror attack and Netanyahu going on CBS and saying, oh, these bloodthirsty terrorists, well, it's all a lie because we know exactly why they did it. They told us they were going to. Anyone in that situation would do that. But at the same time, there are people who take up arms and join resistance groups, but there is also a very bright culture of unarmed resistance. We filmed with Gaza's first b-boy breakdancing crew, and they basically told us the only way for them to maintain their sanity in such conditions, unable to travel, to interact with other dancers, to improve their craft, to just get a taste of the world, was to dance. The way they could keep from losing their minds. You see them in the film. This young painter, Alek Matar, who was a 15-year-old girl and was depressed in her room while these bombs dropped, took up painting by kind of accident, and she blossomed into this incredible artist in a very short time. And now Her work is on display around the world, and she's just one of Gaza's brightest stars. And so we try to show that it's not just about armed resistance, and it's not just about suffering. It's not only Palestinians are victims, but they don't take on this victimhood complex and wallow in their suffering. They find different ways to resist and assert their humanity in the face of unimaginable violence and oppression.
There were so many instances of the slaughter of civilian population, of unarmed civilians, by the Israeli forces. I wonder if you could give us another one or two examples of it. I mean, there are so many in the film.
In addition to listening to us talk about the film, you can rent it or watch it at killinggaza.com. And in killinggaza.com, you will meet Mahmoud Abu Said. He was a 19-year-old who we met outside of the southern city of Rafah. Israeli soldiers came into his area, pulled him out of his house during Ramadan, shot his father, and sent the family marching away, and took him as a human shield back into the house, stood him in front of windows. I mean, the kid was completely traumatized when we met him. And they shot over his shoulders and began sniping his neighbors to death. Then they took him to a prison inside Israel for 2 weeks, and he had just gotten out of prison when we met him. He was just kind of like, he had this look in his eyes of just, his eyes were bloodshot. You could tell he just hadn't been sleeping, and he reenacted the experience for us in a really chilling way on camera. You could see the sniper holes that the Israelis had punched in the walls of his house, and then we walked across the street. It was a surreal experience walking across the street. We felt the crunch of MK-82 500-pound bombs made by General Dynamics in the U.S. under our feet, the shrapnel. We walked over the shrapnel. There were mortars in the street. Houses were just destroyed by bulldozers and bombs. And we met an older man, Suleiman Srebi, who showed us his son's taxi cab, which had been bombed by a drone. He was standing by his house, which had been destroyed by an Israeli missile, and his son had been shot in the head by an Israeli sniper who was using the neighbor, Mahmoud Abu Said, as a human shield. I mean, the amount of violence that was withstood there, the sadistic, unbelievable violence was just mind-boggling. And he said, you know, what can I do? We've been living this violence our whole lives. You build a house, they bomb the house. You till a field, they burn the field. You raise a son, they kill the son. And all we want to do now is resist and resist and resist. We have nothing else to do. And that's the story of Gaza. That's the story of the protests. That's the story of the 58 young people who were cut down by Israeli snipers with laser range finders. And that's what we show in Killing Gaza, along with inspiring stories of resistance.
For every indignity, for every injustice, and there's a myriad way that you show that it happens, there are the smaller and constant indignities and pressures, and yet there are these glorious moments that are there of resistance and individual expression of life. It was the break dancing. It was the young boy singing amidst the rubble of a mosque. I want to talk about what that did for your spirit and your energy and should do for us to support the people of Gaza, the people who are in all of the occupied territories by an increasingly vicious, monstrous state of Israel. Take us to that note, because there was that richness of the human endeavor and the reality of being a freedom fighter.
Everybody is living under immense psychological pressure, you know, where there's a suicide epidemic that gets very little coverage in Gaza. You know, this is just purely a result of deprivation that 2 million people are surviving under. But at the same time, there is, you know, the Arabic word is sumud. The best translation in English is steadfastness. And so that's something that anyone who goes to Palestine with an open mind and an open heart really gets a sense of, and nowhere more than Gaza, where you meet so many people who have been through so much suffering, so much devastation for generations now, but there's this national identity and just something deeper that they really hold on to and maintain in the face of really unimaginable oppression.
Many of the people we know who are our age or younger, they're the English speakers, the educated people, they have been forced to leave and find a life outside of Gaza. Many ways, it's like another Nakba, where they have to leave their families and friends behind. They hope that one day they can come back to Gaza, but meanwhile, Palestinians are hoping they can one day come back to their land and homes in what is now Israel. You just see this gradual process of a society being systematically destroyed, but at the same time, the Palestinian diaspora is filled with all of this talent that's leaving Gaza, and there's a brain drain going on. But there's a lot you can do in your own community, and you know, you can connect with people from Palestine in your community, you can connect with organizations, but it's just really important to mobilize, especially at this time. I really feel like one of the most inspiring things is the way that the debate has been shifted by people who've been fighting pro-Israel lobby and the pro-Israel consensus in the West, and that campaign was really started by Palestinians in the diaspora. The debate is totally shifting in the United States, and Israel knows it. Progressive-minded people generally don't support Netanyahu's Israel, and that support is never coming back. We hope that this film can be a vehicle for helping people understand Gaza and what's been done in their name, with their tax dollars. It should also encourage them to get active within their communities, especially after the massacre we saw and the sort of passive response of U.S. media.
How can people support this film and make sure that it is disseminated? It is one of the most powerful stories of the triumph, really, of the will, of resistance, of freedom, resilience, and creativity of a people who for 70 years plus have been fighting for their land, for their identity, and against one of the most virulent war machines in the world, aided and abetted, financed, and supported by the U.S. governments.
Rent the film at killinggaza.com for $3 and show it to friends at home. If you've been arguing with about Israel-Palestine or who seems to be on the fence, show it to them. Buy the film for $5 and do a screening in your community. And if Dan or I can get there, we'd be happy to participate. KillingGaza.com.
I have nothing but admiration for the work on one of the most important struggles in the world, the issue of Palestine as the question for the instability in the Middle East, for the efforts to work to support a free Palestine. You have given us an enormously important tool to learn from to build support.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.